Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. The Chiefs beat the Bills again. Heartbreaking loss for Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills off a missed Tyler Bass field goal to tie it with a minute left. Brutal, brutal ending to their season once again at the hands of Patrick Mahomes. The Lions are heading to the NFC Championship game. They are going to San Francisco. The Niners beat the Packers. The Ravens dominate the Texans. So we have a Baltimore Chiefs AFC Championship game and a Lions Niners NFC Championship game. The four best teams, really, the entire year. Let's face it. About from like week 10 on, we knew that the best teams in the AFC and the NFC were the Lions and the San Francisco 49ers, and then the Baltimore Ravens and the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, obviously in the AFC, there were, who's the second seed in the AFC? The Dolphins? No, the Bills technically were the second seed in the AFC, but they had to really make it work at the end of the year. A lot of people kind of expected the Chiefs to turn it on. You can't really bet against Patrick Mahomes, even though I tried to bet against Patrick Mahomes. Didn't work. So once again, he's in the AFC Championship game, sixth straight year being in the AFC Championship game. He's never lost in the playoffs prior to that round. Lamar in the AFC Championship game, a chance to get back to the Super, or a chance to get to his first Super Bowl. Mahomes and the Chiefs looking to go back to back. The Lions could make just like unbelievable history getting to a Super Bowl. And the Niners, of course, trying to get back to the Super Bowl as well and really finish what they started last year before Brock Purdy got hurt. So a lot to break down there. And we're going to go over the MLB Hall of Fame ballot that is going to be announced tomorrow, Tuesday at 4 p.m., I think, is the 2024 Hall of Fame ballot is going to be announced. Surely that will go smoothly, I say sarcastically, because the baseball writers are horrible in terms of like how they vote for the Hall of Fame. It's just absolutely pathetic. So let's get started with the NFL playoffs, the divisional round. We'll start with the biggest blowout, and the only blowout of the weekend, the Ravens and the Texans. This was a total second half game. Just pure dominance by the Ravens in the second half. Going to halftime, it was 10-10. You kind of take the 10. You look at it in the box score, and you're like, okay, 10-10 at half. It was pretty competitive. Not entirely. The Houston Texans, their only offensive score, or was this actually their only touchdown, they got completely shut out in the second half, and their only touchdown in the game was a special teams punt return. And that was their only touchdown. So they weren't really moving the ball very well. They never got inside the red zone of the Ravens. They couldn't move the ball. CJ Stroud didn't get sacked in this game, but he was under pressure constantly, having to scramble, throw the ball away, you know, QB knockdowns, all that kind of stuff. Pressures were, you know, all over the place. He was being hounded mercilessly by this very, very good Baltimore Ravens defense. And it was really reminiscent of how their matchup went in week one. I think I said last year, last week they met in week two. It was actually week one. So first game of the season, they just pressured him a lot. They covered everyone downfield really nicely. Couldn't really make the big explosive plays that the Texans had been making. They did a good job of shutting all that down. They pressured CJ Stroud a ton. And it was really just a perfect game plan and an excellent halftime adjustment to the point where, obviously, like I said, they only had one touchdown. It was a special teams punt return touchdown. But shutting them out in the second half, pure dominance from the Ravens, 34-10. They are cranking on all cylinders, and now they have a date hosting the Chiefs, where this is usually the Arrowhead Invitational. You know, the AFC Championship game in Kansas City is a yearly tradition, and now it's in Baltimore. So Patrick Mahomes will be playing his second road playoff game against the number one seeded Baltimore Ravens, who, if there's any team left that feels like they could really knock off the Chiefs, it's going to be the Ravens. Home field advantage. They are a very, 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 very good football team. So we'll see how that goes. But I don't have a whole lot to say about this game. It was definitely the most uneventful. The Ravens rolled. They dominated. They had control basically the entire time. You know, obviously at halftime, there was a little bit like, maybe, you know, the Texans can kind of put it together and keep it close throughout the rest of the game. But Ravens dominated the entire second half and then ended up being a blowout. So not a whole lot to say about this. A lot of what you expected, or at least what like the books expected, the Ravens were 9.5-point favorites. They very, very, very heavily expected to win this game. But the Texans, like, no shame. No shame. Rookie quarterback against a Ravens team that's different. You know, they're on a different level than you guys. And that's what happens when you get to the playoffs, you know. Some teams, if you're just like a little bit better than them in the same kind of tier, you know, there can be some upsets there. But when there is such a drastic difference in talent, it does eventually show up in the playoffs. And that this is one of those instances where the Ravens are just a much better team than the Texans. And that's no fault of the Texans. D'Amico Ryans, really good shot of winning Coach of the Year. Probably my pick for Coach of the Year. He is excellent and has done so much with this Texans team. Steichen and I would say Stefanski are the two other guys that will be there. The three finalists will be him, will be those three guys. You could give it to Stefanski, given everything that Cleveland has had to endure with their quarterback situation and still winning 11 games and still getting to the playoffs and all that. D'Amico Ryans, it could have went to Steichen. He loses out to D'Amico Ryans the final week of the season. They lose the division, and that's that. Like, I feel like in terms of if you were gauging it that way, D'Amico Ryans kind of beats out Shane Steichen just because of he made the playoffs and Steichen didn't. Stefanski and D'Amico Ryans is a toss-up. Like I said, I'm going to go with D'Amico Ryans. But if it goes to Kevin Stefanski, I'm not saying that's a bad choice. But anyway, bright spots all around this roster. Will Anderson is a beast. CJ Stroud is legit. Tank Dell, you know, when he comes back from his injured leg, him and CJ Stroud were getting off to a hot start. Nico Collins is good. Dalton Schultz was a pretty good signing as tight end. You got Devin Singletary has proved to be a pretty good running back. I think Tony Pollard's going to be a free agent at the end of this year. I don't think he re-signs with Dallas. I would like to see him go to the Texans. That would be an interesting little grab, because if him and Singletary split carries, he'll be a lot more effective, because Tony Pollard, as a full-time running back, wasn't very effective this year, unfortunately. So anyway, a lot of bright spots for the Texans moving forward. Nothing to be ashamed of in this game. But like I said, not much to cover here just because everything went so as expected. So we'll get on to the second game Saturday night. The San Francisco 49ers defeating the Green Bay Packers 24-21. And the San Francisco 49ers and Brock Purdy doing something that they have been basically completely unable to do under Kyle Shanahan. And that is win from behind. They were able to do that in this game, outscoring the Packers 10-0 in the fourth quarter to secure the win. The Packers came out really hot in the second half. In the third quarter, they outscored the Niners 15-7 after being down 7-6 at halftime. It was torrential downpouring in this game. A lot of tough difficulty throwing the football for both quarterbacks. Jordan Love didn't play nearly as well as he did against the Cowboys. 21-34, 194 yards, 2 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. The defense really came to play for the Packers. Aaron Jones had a sensational game. And Romeo Doubs is really nice too. I love Romeo Doubs and his big playability. But the Packers, they didn't look bad. They were playing pretty well. You know, Jordan Love wasn't as sharp. They were running the ball super effectively. The defense was playing really well. And they had control of this game until they didn't. Driving down the field, Brock Purdy made some really, really big-time throws on this final drive. The Niners ended up going 12 plays, 69 yards, and burned the final 5 minutes of the game. Five of the 6 minutes of the game, they gave the ball back to the Packers, I think, with a minute and one timeout left. So a pretty difficult situation to put the Packers in. Jordan Love didn't really turn the ball over in the regular season. Didn't throw a lot of interceptions. Took care of the football. And, you know, a lot like C.J. Stroud, both of them first-year starters. That's a huge thing with young quarterbacks, as young starting quarterbacks, is that just don't turn the ball over and things are going to go a lot easier for you. Jordan Love went full tilt Brett Favre. Like, in the pouring rain, he kind of panicked. Like, he tried to use his big arm to make a big play. He kind of panicked, scrambling to his right, on the run, throws the ball back across his body into the middle of the field, which is literally the number one cardinal sin of NFL quarterbacks, is never throw late across the middle of the field, and definitely don't throw across your body back into the middle of the field. And then on top of it, it's pouring rain, and you can see Jordan Love, like, maybe if that was in a dome with no, like, outside environment hindering him, he could have put enough zip on the ball to get it to his receiver. But this ball came out wobbly, it came out soft, and it was just a complete duck in the middle of the field, across his body, on the run, in the rain, multiple 49. I think both Dre Greenlaw and Fred Warner were in position to intercept that ball. And it was picked off by Greenlaw, but Fred Warner was, like, reading that, I think, just as well. So a crazy bad throw by Jordan Love to end the game. Ill-advised, but, you know, he's trying to make a play. He's kind of panicking a little bit, I think, where it's like, I'm going to do something great, and just didn't work out. But, like, that's not his character or his play style, really, because he hasn't turned the ball over. Like, he doesn't, throughout the entire regular season, he has never really made stupid passes like that. And I think just, like, in this moment, I think they ran out of timeouts at this point. They're running out of time. You need a big play. You can't really afford to kind of just check this down. He tries to make it. Didn't happen. But, you know, given the circumstance, he threw that interception with 52 seconds left. So actually, yeah, they burned their only timeout after they converted this first. So they got one first down. They burned their only timeout. Now they have no timeouts. First play after the fresh set of downs at their own 36-yard line is when Jordan Love throws this interception. He tries to get that. It was intercepted at the San Francisco 42. So he was trying to get the ball downfield, get them into field goal range at least with this play. I understand it, but it's just bad decision-making by Jordan Love. Try it. You have a whole minute left. Throw the ball away if you have to. It's first down. You know, no reason to force this into the middle of the field late at all. But so it's a young mistake. It is what it is. Packers in what was considered to be a rebuilding mode. First-year starter Jordan Love. You know, maybe they don't have as much talent around them. They're getting a little bit older. Let's see what Love is made of. Let's see what pieces are great, what we can do. And here they are at the end of the season. They won a playoff game. They beat the Dallas Cowboys in Dallas, dominated the Dallas Cowboys in Dallas. So a very impressive playoff win. And then you go and you play the San Francisco 49ers, where you're double-digit underdogs, 10.5-point underdogs. The line closed out, I'm pretty sure. So no one's expecting you to be in this game. And you are in it until the very end. until the very, very, very end. Just could not hold up there. Finally, the Niners would not be denied. After all, me, myself included, and everybody else saying, you know, the one real glaring weakness that we've seen from the 49ers so far is that they're not really great at playing from behind. They're built to play with a lead. Everyone knows that. Everyone's seen it. It was being talked about by Greg Olsen on the broadcast. Like, they are built to play with a lead. So let's see if they can win from behind. And they answered the call. Brock Purdy, everyone, Brandon Ayuk, George Kittle, McCaffrey scored the game, what ended up being the game-winning touchdown. So all these guys came to play. They got it done. The defense comes up with a turnover at the end of the game to secure it. And the Niners are on to the NFC Championship game, like so many probably predicted at the beginning of the season. So, a great win for the Niners. I mean, this was definitely like monkey off your back kind of situation where, you know, people are talking about you can't play from behind. You're not great from behind. The team gets worse when you're playing without a lead. And if you're Brock Purdy, especially, this is also like critics of him. You know, can Brock Purdy lead the San Francisco 49ers down the field for a game-winning drive? Does he have that in him? Is he just a game manager that plays to the scheme, and when the scheme isn't working, all's lost? Like, that, it's over for them. Can you make it work? And he did. He stepped up when it mattered most. He had a huge, he had a couple of huge passes. So he had a big pass to Ayuk. He had two back-to-back passes, or three passes. He had a big pass to Ayuk, a big pass to Conley, which was a dime to him. It was a nice out route for 17 yards. And then he had a big pass to Kittle. And then this was like, all right, well, now after the Kittle one, you're in the red zone. You get to the 2-minute warning. And then you have McCaffrey do a ton. He scrambled for 9 yards. And then McCaffrey took it in for the touchdown. So a big drive, couple big plays from Brock Purdy, a couple big plays from Christian McCaffrey, and the Niners walk out victorious. So like I said, it was a game that they had to get this monkey off their back, and they did it. You know, because, you know, so even though players would never admit it, it's probably something that they thought about. You know, well, now we're down. What are we going to do? If we lose this game, people can talk. You know, and you want to avoid that. You want to prove doubters wrong. You want to prove haters wrong. Like, hey, look, this whole narrative you created is fake. We can play from behind. We can do it. We can win. And they proved that. Purdy led a great drive down the field, and the Niners were able to win. So they dispelled all that. Maybe not entirely. I'm sure if they, you know, if they don't complete another comeback or something like that, if something like this happens, like against the Lions for some reason, and they can't win, everyone's going to be like, well, maybe we were a little bit premature. But for the most part, you get that off your back. They prove not only to us fans and everyone else that they can do, but they prove it to themselves as well, that they can win from behind. If they need to have a game-winning drive, they can put one together. They are that good of a team. And obviously they're that good of a team, but it was more of just like, that's a pressure thing, you know, and can they handle that pressure? Cause it's real easy to build up a lead and then just crush everybody beneath your feet. But it's a different story to be basically in a slugging match with someone the entire game and then have it come down to like your last possession. You have to score. Otherwise you're going to lose. It's different. But they proved they can do it. They proved they can do it. And the Niners will be hosting the Detroit Lions, who beat the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 31-23 in Detroit. The Lions' second playoff victory. This one also ended with a kind of ill-advised pass by the opposing quarterback, Baker Mayfield, from his own 15 with a minute and a half left. Tries to thread it to Cade Otton, like in the middle of the field, tries to thread it to Cade Otton. He doesn't place the ball high enough, so Barnes, the linebacker that was in coverage, was able to slightly undercut Otton and pick off the ball. If that ball is like 3 or 4 inches higher, Otten's probably, it's either going to fall incomplete or Otten's going to be able to catch that like above his head and no one else is going to be able to get to it. It's a really tough throw to make. Baker tried it, didn't work, but no shame. There should be absolutely no shame in Baker Mayfield for how he played. He is good. Like, he's a good quarterback. He has been an exceptionally good playoff quarterback. If you look at all his playoff stats, in four playoff games Baker Mayfield's been in, the only one he wasn't good is when he was on the Browns and they lost to the Chiefs. That's the only one where he wasn't particularly good. But in the other three, he has 10 touchdowns, two interceptions, 105 rating, and nearly 300 yards per game. He is a good postseason quarterback. Like, he really, really is. And multiple postseason wins now. Yeah, he had the Bucs close. I mean, this year alone, Baker Mayfield has made himself millions of dollars. He has proven everyone wrong, you know, tossed to the curb for a shitty person. And honestly, this year, at least a worse quarterback. And like, can you imagine this Browns team this year with Baker Mayfield as their quarterback? They would have been so much better. They would have been so much better. But Baker, in a year where everyone kind of threw the Bucs aside, didn't think of them twice, you know, they're in a bad division. Oh, Derek Carr is on the Saints. They're pretty talented. They'll probably be the best. Falcons are kind of have always been kind of scrappy. No one really thought of the Bucs in a weird year without Tom Brady. You know, what do they do with this roster? Baker Mayfield comes in. They're somehow able to win the NFC South and then beat the crap out of the Philadelphia Eagles in the wild card round. Go to Detroit and really just battle with the Lions and Jared Goff and battling them the entire time. And, you know, you just come up short. But this is another instance, much like the Green Bay Packers, where the Bucs were in a rebuild mode. And unfortunately for the Bucs, it's a little bit more of a complex situation because Jordan Love's like 25 and Baker Mayfield's 28. So there's a little bit more of an age difference there that you have to account for. But overall, like, Baker, at least a 2-year contract, right? Like, he's made himself good money enough to where he shouldn't really be a journeyman right now. I don't see why the Bucs, given where they're at, like, you don't have a better quarterback on the roster, obviously. You're not going to really be in a position to draft a quarterback, or you're definitely not going to be in a position to draft a quarterback. You maybe can try and trade for someone, but, like, the roster is not particularly young, especially on the defensive end. The roster is not very young. So they got to, they have some good pieces still around in that locker room. There'll be a little bit of a turnover. But Baker, definitely, I think, for the next couple years, at least. Maybe, yeah, a couple years, you give him a contract till he turns 30. Like, I think that will be a good starting point. Maybe he'll even get more. Who knows? But Baker Mayfield has definitely played his way into a contract. Tampa Bay should be celebrating him. He plays his ass off every single week. He's a tough dude. And my loyalty to Baker Mayfield has paid off because I've always been a Baker guy, even when people were trashing him and clowning him and all that kind of stuff. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he was in, like, every single Progressive commercial that aired every 15 minutes. And a lot of people got sick of seeing Baker Mayfield. So I understand that. But now that he's not really in any of those commercials anymore and he's, you know, I guess in a sense been humbled, which I don't really like to think of because he never really... He was always ultra competitive, never really came across as cocky, like never acted like, in my opinion, I don't think he ever acted like he won anything before he actually did. You know, he was cocky. He was confident and he did get humbled in a sense where the Browns so easily discarded him, which honestly didn't even turn out to be the right move because Deshaun Watson hasn't been good when he plays and now he doesn't play and you traded all those picks to the Texans. And now the guy that you dumped off to Carolina, where that didn't work out either because nothing ever works out in Carolina. It's a dumpster fire of an organization. So you can't blame Baker for that. He got the short end of the stick in Cleveland. Things in Tampa Bay didn't work out. Kind of low-key revived himself when he stepped in for the Rams the last couple games of last year when Stafford was out. And, you know, he played on Christmas, I think he was playing. So he gave himself a little bit of a shot there, made the most of it, and Tampa Bay signs him, not really thinking of anything. He's going to be a stopgap guy. He wins the division and he wins a playoff game. You really can't ask for more. Like, he got an opportunity. He made the most of it, and he will be rewarded this offseason for sure. I would be shocked if Tampa Bay didn't reward him in some kind of in ways of at least a short-term stable contract, you know? As for the Lions, so we'll get to the controversy with Tampa Bay and Todd Bowles in a second. I do want to talk quickly about the Lions real quick. Dan Campbell, just a sensational coach, man. Just a literal leader of men in every sense of the word. Jared Goff, so this is from Rich Eisen. The list of QBs to take two different franchises to the championship games this century, so the past 24 years now. Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Brett Favre, Kurt Warner, and Jared Goff. Put some respect on Jared Goff's name. Another guy, much like Baker, you know, two former number one overall picks that kind of got discarded by their original franchises. The Browns, a little bit worse so. I mean, at least with the Rams, it seems to have worked out both ways so far. You'd like to see the Lions get to the Super Bowl to really make good on that. And if they somehow were able to win it, it would be like maybe the greatest and most beneficial two-sided trade for both sides in the history of sports, because then it would end up being that the Rams traded Jared Goff and a couple first-round picks for Matt Stafford. The Rams immediately won a Super Bowl with Matt Stafford, and then a couple years down the line, the Lions used those first-round picks and Jared Goff to build a contender and win a Super Bowl. That would be the best trade in any sport ever. I don't know if the Lions get that far, but they're in an NFC Championship game, and that's pretty damn close considering all things, especially with Jared Goff, with the Rams, was considered a guy, couldn't get it done. You know, a lot of people looked at him as the reason why the Rams couldn't win the Super Bowl, and that's why the Rams made the move for Stafford. The Lions, everyone kind of figured, oh, Jared Goff's a stopgap guy. He's not really going to be, you know, the franchise quarterback that leads this team into the future that they're trying to build. And he is that guy. He ended up being that guy. And the Lions have just been, they've done such an incredible job with drafts. Aiden Hutchinson, Penei Sewell falling to them. People forget that Penei Sewell was supposed to be a top five pick, and for whatever reason, he fell to seven, and the Lions were ecstatic. They took him. Free agents, Jahmyr Gibbs, they took a little bit high, but he's been sensational. Free agent signings with David Montgomery has been elite. They've built a very good, I mentioned Penei Sewell as their draft pick, but overall, their offensive line, they've built a very, very good offensive line. They have a great tandem of running backs, and you know, they drafted Sam Laporta, who's an absolute beast in his rookie year. He's arguably, he's already in his rookie year, a top three tight end in all of football. Amon-Ra St. Brown is arguably a top five wide receiver in football. He's easily top 10. Just a lot of weapons on offense that they've been able to perfectly balance with drafts and free agent signings. And then the same thing on defense, cornerstone guy in Aiden Hutchinson that they draft, and then everyone else, you know, they're able to draft other guys that plug in there, and able, like Brian Branch, good draft pick, signing guys like CJ Gardner-Johnson, just being able to build what they've built is very impressive. You got to tip your cap to ownership, and with ownership, you have Sheila Ford Hamp, who took over as the proprietary owner of the Detroit Lions from her mother, Martha Firestone Ford. Once she took over, things changed. That's when she hired the right GM. She hired Dan Campbell. She was building a contender. Like, she had a vision. Dan Campbell talks about how, like, when the first Zoom meeting they had, when she laid out her vision, like, he knew this is like the direction that they needed to go in. He was ecstatic to work with her. And like, she has been a huge proponent literally since she's taken over. The Lions have drafted as well as that. Like, she hired the right people and they've nailed it every single step of the way to get to where they are now. It's sometimes really all it takes is an owner who understands their boundaries, how much to be involved with, who to hire, who to fire, it all really does come down to the owner. And sometimes when you just have a really bad owner, things will never change. Kind of like a lot of teams in the league, right? But when you are able to change things and able to have a vision and execute on that vision, so many great things can happen. And now here are the Detroit Lions in the NFC Championship game. It really, really is something special. And they have a great, great team that is pretty young. I mean, David Montgomery feels old. He's like 28. Gibbs is a rookie. Laporta's a rookie. Amon-Ra St. Brown's 25. Even Jared Goff like feels like he's old because he's been around and he's been traded, but he's only 29. You know, he's still got a lot of good years left. So there's a lot of really great things ahead for the Detroit Lions. And I'm happy for their fans, dude. I really, really am. And, you know, Dan Campbell, everyone keeps talking about Dan Campbell because he was on the 0-16 Lions team. And now here he is as their head coach, turning this franchise around single-handedly. Not single-handedly, obviously. I just mentioned all the reasons why they've been successful. But he has been the guy. You know, he's been the leader. And he has helped drive this team forward. And when he talks, it's really easy to listen and be revved up, you know. And I can't imagine what it's like actually playing for him. Probably never feels like you're out of it. Always confident that you can pull it together and you can win. Always confident that you can execute when you need to, and they did execute here. It was great. I mean, it's just great for the Lions. It's great for Detroit. And, you know, I'm big on the Niners. I love the Niners, and I'd really like to see the San Francisco 49ers win the Super Bowl, but I need to root for Detroit. I need to root for Detroit and Baltimore. Like, that is what I want, because that's like a new Lamar MVP, the year of the Harbaughs, like really capping off a great football season, best number one seed. Lamar finally shuts up all his critics and just arguably the best team in football all year. Winning a championship is something that is, it feels like, all right, it's deserving, you know. But and then if you had them playing the Lions, that's just, you know, a city that's just been drowning in trash, like bad sports teams for decades at this point. I mean, when was the last good Detroit team? 10 years ago, the Tigers were in the World Series. It's like more than 10 years ago, I think 2012, right? Or maybe it was 2014 when they lost to the Giants. Forget which one of the years it was. But I guess that was the last time, because the Tigers haven't really been good since then. They just sent Miguel Cabrera off into the sunset. And the Pistons are literally going to win less games this year than the Detroit Lions did, which is insane. And then, of course, obviously with the Lions, they've just been so dysfunctional. One of the worst teams in football for years. It's great, man. And then the Red Wings, I think the Red Wings kind of, the Red Wings were really good when I was growing up. The Pistons were really good when I was growing up. So it's crazy from when I was younger to see like Detroit. And then the Lions were always competitive. I've seen the Tigers were always competitive. I've seen the Tigers in 3 World Series, I think. So they were like always good, dude. I always competitive. Or maybe it was 2 World Series, but still, like, I've seen the Tigers in the World Series. They've always been competitive. They've always been tough. And then the Pistons, like the Pistons winning a finals. I got to see that. And Ben Wallace, Chauncey Billups, Tayshaun Prince, Rip Hamilton, loved those guys, dude. Like, seeing the Pistons were always a good team. And the Tigers were always a good team, and the Red Wings were a good hockey team too. Now none of the teams are really good, and now the Lions are finally back. So, well, the Tigers are actually horrible. The Pistons are like a joke, and I haven't checked what the Red Wings are, but I don't think they're particularly good, and they haven't been for quite some time. So now you have the Lions finally back. Hopefully it sends a message to the rest of Detroit. Like, hey, the Lions are good now. Maybe like we should try and get our shit together. Like, let's not be the laughingstock of this city. You know, everyone, we were all laughingstocks for the past several years. Every team's been a laughingstock. So like, what if now maybe we just change it? We turn it around. Let's see. So it's very cool, man. It's very cool to see how the Lions have built this thing. As for the final seconds of the game, Jared Goff made a boo-boo. Jared Goff was not paying attention, and I don't think any of the fans were paying attention either, because, and I don't even know if the announcers were paying attention, because with about the Bucs had one timeout, and the Lions were going into victory formation. They were at the Tampa Bay, like, 30, I think, and they were kneeling the ball. The play clock gets below, or the game clock gets below 40 seconds. Goff snaps the ball and knees it. Now, if the Bucs had no timeouts, then it doesn't matter. The game's over. The game clock is more than the play clock, and you just run it out, triple zeros, game over. But the Bucs had one timeout left. So they elected to not use their timeout and then just let the game clock run out, where if they did call the timeout, everyone's saying, like, why didn't the Bucs use this timeout? And everyone's saying, like, well, the Lions would have just kicked a field goal, and the game, it would have been an 11-point game, and the game would have been over. Oh, really? I didn't realize that field goals were just automatic now. It is really bad. Like, this is why Todd Bowles might have to actually lose his job, unfortunately, despite, like, the success that they had this season, all things considered, is because of things like that. To not call the timeout with 38 seconds left and force the Lions to kick the field goal is insane to me. Like, that is such loser mentality and loser talk. It is just complete coaching malpractice to not force the Lions in a playoff game. Call the timeout, force them to kick the field goal. If they kick the field goal, then it's all good. Like, you know, you want to kick the ball off. They make the field goal. They kick the ball off. You get it. If you want to take a kneel, I don't think anyone's going to look at you and be like, that's a loser mentality. Like, you're down double digits. The 38 seconds left. The game's over. Right? If you want to do that, then fine. But, like, field goals have been blocked. We've seen worse field goals be missed. There is absolutely no reason why Todd Bowles should have not called that timeout. That you need to call a timeout there 10 times out of 10. It is malpractice for him to do that. And please miss me with the, well, they would have kicked the field goal and it would have been a double digit lead anyway. That is ridiculous, dude. Absolutely ridiculous. So just, I mean, no one, it's crazy because I watched the end of this game on TV while I was at work, but like, I didn't notice. I don't think the announcers noticed. I don't think anyone in the stadium noticed. Jared Goff and Dan Campbell didn't notice, because if they did, you would have just ran that. If they noticed, Jared Goff would have waited for the play clock to get all the way down to like 3 seconds, and then he would snap the ball and kneel it. And then if the Bucs really did use their timeout, then you're only going to have around like 10 seconds, 13 seconds, whatever. And then the Lions would still have to kick the field goal anyway. Okay. But like, why? No one noticed. So unless the Bucs just wave the white flag and we're just like, hey, we're not going to call this timeout. Like, the game's over. Don't even bother. Like, we're just kneel it out and we'll let the clock hit zero. I don't know why you would do that. That is like, this is a playoff game, bro. This is not a regular season matchup. This is a playoff game. You need to call that timeout. If for nothing other than to just instill like a sliver of chance in your players and get them to, and show them, lead them to fight till the very end, the very, very bitter end. Do you think Dan Campbell would have left the timeout on the board and just conceded the game? No. So why is Todd Bowles with what would have been 38 seconds and no timeouts, why are you not forcing the Lions to kick a field goal there instead of just letting them run the clock out? It is really, that was really bad, dude. That was a really, really, really bad decision by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Todd Bowles, and it might cost him his job. Like, all things considered, with Baker Mayfield and with the Bucs and everything, I've been pretty wrong with the coaching decisions. Shockingly enough, the Eagles, who was it? The Eagles are going to keep Nick Sirianni. The Cowboys are going to keep Mike McCarthy. And the Saints are going to keep Dennis Allen. So somehow those three guys all survived their hot seats and they're going to stay. They're going to stay as coaches of their teams, which is nuts. Todd Bowles was a guy I thought maybe, you know, fire him. He could be on the hot seat. Thinking after he makes the playoffs, there's no way they fire him now. Then they win a playoff game. Now it's like, all right, security. But this is like an egregious, this trumps the wins, honestly. This is like a pathetic miscalculation. Like, whichever way you want to splice it, like, if he didn't know they had a timeout, if no one knew they had a timeout, I just, unless it was a graphic malfunction where they actually used all three of their timeouts and we just didn't know it, but I doubt that's the problem. So I don't like it, dude. I do not like that decision at all to just let the Lions get off scot-free. You can't just assume that they would make that field goal. That's crazy talk. Again, if you force them to kick the, just force them to make the field goal. If they make it, then so be it. You get the ball, you can kneel it out, and everyone goes home. But like, you have to at least force them. What if you block it? If they miss it, what? Like, I don't get it, dude. I really don't get it. That was bad. That was really, really, really bad. Final game of the night. It was a doozy, much anticipated. Chiefs at Bills. The Chiefs win again, 27-24. And now, of course, all the narratives are that just Josh Allen is just Phillip Rivers. Like, well, it just might be that. He might just be Phil Rivers, where they're good at, the Bills are just good every year. They'll win a playoff game, and they run into Patrick Mahomes every year. Last year, actually, it was Joe Burrow, but still, like, just running into him every single year, and he gets the better end of it. And listen, Mahomes, he gets the touchdown to put them up 27-24. This was very much like a Bills lost this game. First of all, let's be real. The Bills should not, this game should not have even ended in a heartbreaking missed field goal by Tyler Bass. This shouldn't even ended like that, because Sean McDermott, inexplicably, because he thinks this is a fucking Disney Channel movie, gives the ball to Damar Hamlin on a fake punt inside his 30-yard line or inside his 40-yard line. Gives the ball to Damar Hamlin on a direct snap for a fake punt. He gains 2 yards. He needed 5. And they turn the ball over to the Chiefs. And then somehow, some way, Mecole Hardman is dumb enough, 2 yards outside of the end zone, try to reach for the end zone. The ball comes loose before he hits the ground. The ball dribbles out of the back of the end zone, out of the side of the end zone, and it's a touchback, and the Bills get the ball back. That is the only reason Sean McDermott should have killed the Bills right there. There is no reason why they should have been in this game until the very end. If Mecole Hardman is not a moron, like if he just tucks that ball away and gets tackled, the Chiefs run that in with Isaiah Pacheco from the 2 yard line. And now all of a sudden they have a 10 point lead and it's over. Like there's nothing really you can do from there. So I think that it would have been a 10 point lead with like 7 minutes left. So that is a complete bailout by Mecole Hardman and the Chiefs, because Sean McDermott made the dumbest decision with like 12 minutes left. 12 and a half minutes left, 2 timeouts, or maybe all your timeouts, but 12 minutes left inside your own 40. Like, punt the ball. You're down by 3 points. Punt the ball and try and get a stop. Okay, bud? That's the easiest decision you can make. So they get bailed out there, and then they drive down the field, 16 plays, 6.5 minutes, and with about a minute left, Tyler Bass misses right on the 40-yard field goal, I believe it was. Misses wide right, and you can see it really kind of, I don't know if it maybe if it was wind or what, but it was, he kicked it hard, and it just whips to the right, and he misses it. So game's over from there. There were 3 big mistakes for the Bills at the end of this game. Not all of it's on Josh Allen. Hardly any of it's on Josh Allen. A lot of it's on Sean McDermott. And a lot of it's on Stephon Diggs. So, with the 3 mistakes, the first mistake You have with about 8 minutes left in the game, I think it is. Josh Allen throws the ball deep to Stephon Diggs. It's like a 50 yards in the air, absolute bomb to Stephon Diggs. He's in one-on-one coverage. He has a step. He's open. He jumps up and he goes to like make a cradle catch, and the ball just goes through right through his arms. Right through his arms. Incomplete. Now, he probably would have been tackled after he caught that ball. So I'm not saying it would have been like a touchdown. And even if it was, that certainly wouldn't have been a touchdown that ended up winning the game, because you still have like plenty of time on the clock. So there's no guarantee, obviously, that that wins the game for the Bills, but it puts them pretty close to the red zone. And it is a huge momentum shifter. Like, that is an enormous momentum shifter. You felt the collective, like, holding of their breath in the entire stadium, Bills and Chiefs fan, everyone kind of holding their breath, like, is this it? Is this going to be the play? Like, he chucked it, dude. It was a dime. It was a dime. And Stephon Diggs has not really been good. The back end of the season, he's really not been that big of a factor. He hasn't been a factor in the playoffs. And he wasn't really a factor in this game either. And honestly, you got to give a little credit or a lot of credit to Legarius Sneed and Trent McDuffie, who are both. Trent McDuffie was an All-Pro. Legarius Sneed certainly deserved the honor because he is a very good defensive back, and they just go one-on-one with their guys a ton. And Diggs, whether he was in the slot or in the outside, is going up against them a majority of the time. So credit to them for being able to lock him down. But that was a huge, huge momentum shifting opportunity for Buffalo. The second mistake was a Josh Allen mistake. It's 2nd and 9, out of the 2 minute warning. Josh Allen, he has Shakir open in the end zone, and he throws the ball under. He underthrows the ball. It falls incomplete. But the problem with that is that not so he misses the throw, but Stephon Diggs was wide open underneath. I mean, he just ran a drag route over the middle of the field, and if Allen just throws him the ball, Diggs probably catches that and runs for another like 7 or 8 yards for a first down, and the drive continues. But instead, he took a shot at the end zone, and then the last play, the 3rd and 9 play, he ends up throwing it away, and they settle for a 44-yard attempt from Tyler Bass, which is the 3rd and final mistake for the Buffalo Bills. They come in threes. So the first play of that drive was the incompletion to Diggs. The first play was the first mistake on the incomplete pass to Diggs, the miss by Diggs. The second mistake was the first play after the 2 minute warning, and then the 3rd and final mistake was the 44-yard attempt that sailed right for Tyler Bass. So not that it came down to those three plays, but those are on that final drive, that 16-play final drive for the Bills. It felt to me that when they got to around midfield, I'm like, all right, you pick up another first down here. Now you're looking at like, let's try and drain the clock and score a touchdown at the same time. Now you have to take that into consideration. And they were doing a really good job until all of a sudden they weren't. And then Josh Allen, a couple bad play calls in a row, a couple bad just executions in a row. And now you have to settle for a 44-yard field goal, which is definitely not what they wanted. And something that, you know, if the play calling was a little bit better, you could have just chipped away at those yardage. But they settled for it. Tyler Bass has a big leg. He's been pretty good in these spots, and he sails it right, which I'm sure Bills fans, older Bills fans, know about. It is just really like a curse having to be in this position all the time. And I know with Josh Allen, it's probably weighing heavy on him at this point, where it's just like, he said it in his postgame presser, like, it just sucks. You know, it sucks. And like, to not be able to get past Mahomes and the Chiefs, which, you know, like, I don't really want to rag on Josh Allen that much, because like, who is he losing to? He's not losing to people that he isn't supposed to lose to. You know, it's not like he's being beaten by quarterbacks that are less talented or teams that are less talented than the Bills, which, first of all, the Bills, of course, are completely banged up. They have, outside of Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde, their entire defensive back end secondary was really banged up. Their linebackers were shot. A lot of injuries on defense. They don't have Gabe Davis on offense. Like, just a lot of injuries across this entire team. And they were still able to play really good football. And it wasn't enough. But you look at Josh Allen, like, oh, the one real bad game he had was last year against Cincinnati. That was like the one real bad playoff game that the Bills have had so far in this Josh Allen tenure, where it was just like embarrassing to the point where you're like, what, how did this happen? Like, what are they doing? And that was against the Bengals. But every other game, really, I mean, they lost to the Chiefs by double digits in one of the playoff games too. But, you know, it's like he's losing to Patrick Mahomes, and then he lost once to Joe Burrow, two quarterbacks who we consider to be five of the best quarterbacks in all of football. Those are three of the five best quarterbacks in football right there. You throw in Lamar, that's four. You know, everything else, whatever. Up for debate. I'm not sure where you want to go from there. But, like, those four are probably the best four quarterbacks in all of football. And he's losing these games to these guys. It's hard to criticize him in a way that's like, oh, it's his fault. Or, like, he has to play better. Like, he played well. He played very well. And I think the Bills played pretty well. I think McDermott made a lot of really bad mistakes. I think the play calling didn't do the Bills any favors either. So it could be more of coaching than actual personnel for the Buffalo Bills right now. Again, just look at who they're playing. They're playing quarterbacks that are considered to be in the same tier as Josh Allen and better head coaches. You know, Zach Taylor is a better head coach than Sean McDermott. Andy Reid is a much better coach than Sean McDermott. It just is what it is at this point, you know? And they are going up against, they're just going up against a buzzsaw every single time. And you're coming really close, dude. You're almost there, and you fall short every single time. And it's just got to be incredibly frustrating. Josh is going to be, I think, 27 or 28. 27, I think he's going to be, because I think he's 26 right now, or maybe he's 27. But, you know, he's not getting any younger. He's still obviously a beast, and he's got a lot of years left, but he's not getting any younger. Stephon Diggs is 30. You know, he's certainly not getting any younger. The team that you have now, it feels like your window is either, if it's not entirely closed yet, it is rapidly closing. And you really need to figure out what you're doing in the future, and you have to figure it out quickly. But right now, it's like you just can't seem to break through this barrier, which is very reminiscent of the San Diego Chargers and Philip Rivers, who they have, you know, Rivers, like Josh Allen, has great stats. He wins a lot of games. That their team is always really good and in the playoff picture and at the top of their conference. And then they win one playoff game, maybe two, if it's like a really, really, really good year. And then they lose. It's just like they can't. With Rivers, it was, you know, Brady, Big Ben, even, I don't know if the Chargers ever lost to Joe Flacco and the Ravens, but, and then Peyton Manning, of course, you know, obviously. So he had to go through all those guys. And now Mahomes has to go through Lamar, Burrow, and Mahomes. Everyone has to go through Mahomes. Literally everybody, until proven otherwise, everyone has to go through Mahomes, which is why the game next week in Baltimore with the Chiefs and the Ravens is so interesting. But yeah, my final thoughts on the Bills real quick, and then we talk about the Chiefs and then the matchups next week. I don't obviously blame Josh Allen. I don't really blame Tyler Bass. You have to make the field goal. I do blame Tyler Bass a little bit. You have to make the field goal, dude. That's so bad. I blame Diggs a little bit, because Diggs just looks like he doesn't care. Like, Stephon Diggs that entire game just looked like he didn't care, which is bad. I mean, it's not good. Not good at all. But the Bills are good. They're going to continue to be good as long as Josh Allen's their quarterback. They need like something extra. I think maybe one time they'll get Mahomes. Maybe one time, but I don't know. It's bad. It's tough. It's a tough situation to be in. With the Chiefs, I mean, I bet on the Bills. I was rooting for the Bills. I wanted to see them do it. You know, I wanted to see them. It's always nice for change, you know, and it's not because I was doubting Mahomes. It's because I was supporting Josh Allen. And now we have Mahomes versus Lamar, which is another one where it's like Mahomes is, I mean, he is Brady, where it's like Brady every single playoff game. It's like, oh, Peyton's going to get him this time. Nope. Philip Rivers is going to get him this time. Nope. Nope. And he just keeps on trucking. And that is Patrick Mahomes, Andy Reid, Travis Kelce, which Mahomes and Kelce actually surpassed Gronk and Brady for most tight end, for most quarterback receiver touchdown combo in playoff history, with 17, I think. Brady and Gronk had 16. So they just continue to dominate and be great. And they are, like I said, an absolute buzzsaw. And it's like, at this point, he's in the territory where it's like, why are you betting against him? Bet against him at your own risk, which is what I do. I'll probably bet against him again. Actually, he's like 10-0, I think, against the spread when he's an underdog in like the, since he's been a starter in the playoffs, or not in the playoffs, like all time. So I think I might have to take the Chiefs plus 3.5 in this game against the Ravens, but I will be supporting the Ravens. I would like them to win. I would like to see the Ravens in the Super Bowl. I mean, listen, it literally is bet against at your own risk. Mahomes is the guy to beat until he's not. Like, the Chiefs are going to win until they don't. It's at that point now. 6 straight AFC championship games. Like I said before, he's never lost in a round before the championship game. He is different, dude. He is different. And I think if he just wins, he doesn't even have to get to, I don't even know if he has to get to 5 Super Bowls. Let's just say he wins 2 more Super Bowls his entire career, and that's being on the low end probably. And he just continues to rack up AFC championship appearances. We're going to talk about him. He's just the GOAT, period. I don't think he's there yet. I think there are just so, people are really bringing up that playoff wins stat right now, where, which I think is stupid, because quarterback wins aren't considered a very reliable stat for the regular season, but now for the postseason, apparently they are. So he's like, well, everyone's saying Mahomes got his 13th playoff win. It's already more than Peyton, Elway, and all Brett Favre, like all these great all-time Hall of Fame quarterbacks. In Mahomes' like 7th year as a starter, or his 6th year as a starter, whatever it is, he already has more playoff victories than all of them, which is fine. Like, that's a cool stat. And it's like, wow, the Chiefs have been really good since he's been their quarterback. And that is, you know, you attribute a lot of that to him. But that's just like, I don't really care for that stat. But there are just so many other things that are like, Tom Brady is the GOAT for a reason. So I think we are being a bit premature in terms of like, Patrick Mahomes is the best quarterback I've ever seen, because Tom Brady's still the best quarterback I've ever seen. Like, he just always gets it done. And then Mahomes always gets it done too. Like, I'm certainly not going to say like, call people idiots or like, you're flat out wrong. Like, completely shut it down if they say Mahomes is the greatest quarterback they've ever seen. That's fine. But I mean, Tom Brady's Tom Brady. So I think people are so quick to like move on to the next thing, you know, and be like, oh, this guy's the next great thing. And maybe this is how people feel with Jordan and LeBron, but like, LeBron's been doing it. He's in year 21, you know, like I remember early on when the LeBron Jordan debate started going on and people were like, absolutely not, blah, 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 blah. I kind of, when he's, you know, when LeBron was 27, 28, 29, even 30 years old, and people were comparing him, like, I get why that would be a bit frustrating and would be something that's like, no way, no way. But like now at year 21, with all that he's accomplished, it's kind of hard to deny that, or at least in the fact that like you can at least have a much better argument now than you could 10 years ago about it. Like now it's almost come to a point where that debate has kind of ended, and it's either like you either think LeBron's the best, you think Jordan's the best, and either way no one's going to really change their mind, and that's just is what it is. You fall on either side of the aisle and that's where you'll remain forever. But with Brady and Mahomes, it's like Mahomes hasn't done nearly enough to, and he's certainly going to be regarded, like if he retired today, he'd be regarded as one of the best quarterbacks ever. But like to be in the same contention as a dude who went to 10 Super Bowls, won 7 of them, and countless AFC title appearances, AFC championship game appearances, all these different records for yards and passes throughout entire careers. You know, most yards, most touchdowns, all that stuff. It's you gotta pump the brakes a little bit on Mahomes being the GOAT. That's all I'm saying. It's just he needs to add some longevity in there and totality stats to really be into that conversation. In terms of playoff success, you have a much better in terms of him being like one of the best playoff quarterbacks ever, then yeah, there's not really any denying that. He's been basically flawless his entire playoff career. So That's a little bit different, but in terms of like the total GOAT conversation, let's pump the brakes a bit. All right, going to conference championship weekend, the matchups, the first game at 3:00, Chiefs, Ravens. Like I said, this game is Ravens -3.5. I might have to take the Chiefs just because it's Mahomes getting points. Can't see him losing by more than 3. I would be shocked. Although this Ravens team's really good. Maybe they just beat the shit out of the Chiefs. Who knows? But I haven't seen it yet. So it would be quite the shock if the Ravens beat the shit out of the Chiefs. I'll be honest. I am pulling for the Ravens. Although I just said I like the points for the Chiefs, I am pulling for the Ravens. I'd like to mix it up. You know, I'm not entirely sure I want to see Patrick Mahomes win another Super Bowl. But I am going to be rooting for the Ravens. And I think it's going to be a tough, I mean, that both defenses are very good. They are the strongest part, I would say. Obviously, they have two dynamic elite quarterbacks with Lamar and Patrick Mahomes. But the defenses as a unit are the best units left. I mean, you look across the board, out of the four teams remaining, who's the outlier? The Lions defense is the outlier. All three other teams, the Niners, Ravens, and Chiefs, all have elite level defenses. So that is something to, you know, account for. I think this could definitely be a grinded out type of game where it's like, you know, a couple touchdowns each, and that's really it. I'd be surprised if this ended up being like, you know, a 31-27 type of game. That feels like a lot of points for these defenses, and I just don't see that happening. So I'll probably take the under, honestly. As gross as it would be to bet the under on a Mahomes-Lamar game, I think I might do it, dude. This could be a grind it out, run the ball, play defense type of AFC championship game. But of course, with the Ravens, Lamar, AFC championship game has already done a lot for his resume and the doubters, but getting to a Super Bowl would do even more. He's going to win MVP, so the Super Bowl appearance with the MVP is going to look real nice for him. Continue to be the year of the Harbaughs with, you know, Jim already winning the national title at Michigan and John now with a chance to go back to the Super Bowl to win his second Super Bowl. Could do a lot. You could do a lot with the Ravens if they were to get there. And then obviously with the Chiefs, they're looking to be back-to-back champs. Which I think the Chiefs being back-to-back champs would be the first back-to-back Super Bowl wins since Brady did it in the early 2000s, right? I'm pretty sure that would be it. So pretty crazy. It's very, very difficult to repeat in the NFL. It's probably the most difficult sport to repeat in. We've seen it pretty recently with the Lightning, Tampa Bay Lightning in hockey. We've seen it pretty recently with the NBA as well, with the Warriors, and then the Warriors dynasty. And then with baseball, I think the last time there was a back-to-back champ in baseball was the Yankees, the 90s dynasty Yankees. The Lakers won 3 in a row and the Yankees won 3 in a row. And those were the last 2 three-peat champions in any sport. So it's been 2+ decades of teams not winning a three-peat. It's incredibly difficult to do that. But back-to-back is still very difficult to do. Football, like I said, I'd probably say football is the hardest, just because getting there is so difficult. And it only takes like one game to completely ruin your season. If you just screw up one game, like that's it. There is no do-over. Whereas, you know, every other sport, it's like you can come out flat in game one, but then games 2, 3, and 4, you're dominant, you know? So it is probably the hardest to repeat as a Super Bowl champion, but the Chiefs are looking to do it. NFC Championship game, the Niners are hosting the Lions. 7-point favorites right now, 7.5-point favorites for the San Francisco 49ers. This is another thing where the Lions are cool. I love the Lions. I will be rooting for them, but it just feels like this is where their holes start to show. You know, the defense kind of being inconsistent, the back end of that defense allowing big plays. This is where the Niners really, like, they hit them hard and they hit them early, and then they play with the lead. The Lions are going to have to make some big stops. They're going to have to force turnovers. I think that's if the Niners turn the ball over, that is a huge part of the recipe for the Lions to win. If the Niners turn the ball over, I don't know how much they're going to do that. I don't know if they're going to do that at all, but it's going to be a tough one for the Lions, man. It's going to be real, real, real tough. And if they lose this game, if they get blown out in this game, I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of. Would it be a devastating end to their season? Obviously, you know, whether they lost by 20 or 3 points, it doesn't matter. It'd be a devastating loss either way. But to just be able to get to this point, you know, you add a couple more pieces. People might want to add, like, you might get a bigger free agency pool. People want to come play for Detroit now and Dan Campbell and see what he's about. Like, yeah, I want to play for that dude. It could be a hot spot for the next few years. Being in Detroit, being a Lion could be a hot spot. So I'm going to be rooting for the Lions a lot. I just, with the way the Niners play and that defense, man, I mentioned it. What the biggest outlier out of the remaining 4 teams is that the Lions don't even have nearly as good of a defense as the other 3 teams. They just don't. It is such a drastic difference that I think that's probably what does them in. Again, unless they're able to force some turnovers, maybe strip sack Brock Purdy, tip a ball at the line and pick it off. These are some of the things that are going to have to happen if they really want a shot, because I don't really think they're not going to be able to score enough points to win in like a shootout, because the Niners defense probably just won't allow that. And if, you know, they get behind early, that's where the Niners thrive. So they got to force some turnovers. That's the key to the game. You got to get to Brock Purdy. You got to sack him and you got to force some turnovers. It's all a lot easier said than done. Definitely an uphill battle for Detroit, but I will be pulling for them. It's one of those things for me with the NFC. Honestly, with either one of these matchups, it's like I'm rooting for the Ravens and the Lions, but if it ends up being the Niners and the Chiefs or the Ravens and the Niners, I'm not going to be surprised or disappointed. Any way these games shape up, I'm not going to be disappointed. And I'm not really going to, I might be surprised if the Lions beat the Niners, but I'm not going to be disappointed in any Super Bowl matchup that we get. I like all 4 of these teams remaining. I think they're all great. They're all fun to watch. They all certainly deserve to be there, you know, because you can easily make the argument that these are the 2 best teams in each conference all year. I'm very, very much looking forward to Sunday. 3:00 is Chiefs Ravens. 6:30 is the Lions and the Niners. So, to wrap up, we'll talk about the Hall of Fame. announcement that will happen Tuesday at 4 p.m. No doubt I'll be pissed off with either the complete disregard for some people to vote, with some writers deciding to reveal their ballots. I'm no doubt I'll be pissed off when, you know, a guy shows his ballot and he voted for one person. It'll be like Bobby Abreu or something like that. Like, that'll piss me off. No doubt I'll be pissed off when Chase Utley gets in, because Chase Utley certainly is not a good baseball player, not a Hall of Famer. Not even close. Especially when guys like Jimmy Rollins are barely hanging on to the ballot. He won an MVP. Chase Utley was never the best player on the Phillies ever at any point. It's like Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins were always better than him. He was clutch. He beat up on the Mets. His career stats are not good. He has no discernible milestones. People are going to point at me and be like, well, he has a 40-something plus war and like, look at his OPS plus. Shut up, loser, you nerd. No, Chase Utley, for any person who actually watched Chase Utley, not a Hall of Fame baseball player. Good baseball player? Yes, certainly 100%. Not a Hall of Famer, I'm sorry. But, you know, Scott Rowland got in, so anything's possible now. Now they've opened the floodgates, so who knows? But, like, they'll leave Gary Sheffield off because he was loosely associated with steroids. Gary Sheffield has 500 freaking home runs, and he might not get in on his final year on the ballot, but they'll put Chase Utley in the Hall of Fame. You expect me to believe that Chase Utley was a better baseball player than Gary Sheffield? You're a moron. So, here's the returning ballot. I wrote a blog on this. When they announced the ballot a few months ago, check it out on Animal House. But Todd Helton's returning. He got 72.2% of the vote last year. This is his sixth year on the ballot. He will undoubtedly get in this year. He only needs about three more, or actually less than 3% of the vote to get in. He will definitely crack that this year. Billy Wagner has a really good shot to get in this year as well. This is his ninth year on the ballot. He's at 68% of the vote. So he needs another 7%. To get in. Andrew Jones is in his seventh year of the ballot. He's at 58.1%. Another player that's better than Chase Utley that might not get in. Andrew Jones, a beast, one of the best defensive center fielders of all time, and had such a high peak offensively. His one glaring issue is that by the time he was like 30 years old, his career was basically over. He didn't have much longevity in the league. Came in super early, was starting for the Braves at 19, 20 years old. So he played a decade in the league, but didn't have that longevity that a lot of people like in baseball. But he's at 58.1%. And then the next couple of close guys, you have Gary Sheffield, who was at 55%. He's in his 10th year and final year on the ballot. 55 is a long way. 20%, a 20% jump in your final year on the ballot. Like, guys in their 10th year always generally get that extra bump up. But 20% is a lot. 20% is a lot. And I just unfortunately don't see the writers coming together to do that justice for Gary Sheffield and to make up for that difference. He should have been in long ago. He has over 500 home runs. I don't care what, like, I don't think he showed up in any steroids report. But I'm a very much like, there is a difference between guys who were good because they took steroids and good guys who took steroids. Be honest, they're... The steroids don't make the baseball player. They just enhance what's ever there. So if you're not very good and you take steroids, you're going to be a better, but you're not going to be like suddenly this all-star, like Hall of Fame level player. It's just not going to happen. If you're already really good and then you take steroids, then you're going to put up like crazy numbers, right? So Gary Sheffield, man, I don't know. He's been kind of the same player for a really long time. And I really like Gary Sheffield too. So I guess I'm a little biased, but he certainly deserves, even after, like, he wasn't really a fan being on the Yankees. And so I've like, that would give me reason to be like, I didn't really like him because of his tenure on the Yankees. But like, that didn't really change my opinion on him at all. I really enjoyed Gary Sheffield growing up and watching him play baseball. He has the milestones. He has a 60.5 war, and if you're a war guy, that blows Chase Utley out of the water. He has almost 2,700 hits, 509 home runs. He's a career 292 hitter, so he's not just power. He hits for average. He has a World Series with the Marlins. I don't really see how Gary Sheffield isn't a Hall of Famer, but here he is sitting at 55% of the vote on his final year on the ballot. It's going to be very difficult for him to get in. Carlos Beltran, another guy that I think should have been a surefire Hall of Famer. He's going into his second year on the ballot, so he has plenty of time to get in. But he's sitting at 46.5% currently. A-Rod is at 35.7%, and he's on his third year on the ballot. So this is really where we drop off. I think A-Rod, because he's become so likable and such a an advocate of the game. I mean, he's always been an advocate for baseball. He loves baseball. He loves the MLB. He loves the game, bro. He loves the game. There is maybe not another athlete. Like, A-Rod is at, like, LeBron levels of loving. Being his, like, IQ and his love of the game are, like, equal. You know, they're just out of this world. And he's a student of the game. He loves promoting it. He certainly deserves to be a Hall of Famer. I know the steroids and everything, but, like, he was a Hall of Famer before the steroids. I just think he's so great, man. And he's done so much to revamp his image and to just spread the game the way he does. He deserves it. I would like, if he makes a jump, like if A-Rod makes the jump to like, if he gets like a 10% bump this year, we could be looking really good. Outside of that, Manny Ramirez, the media never liked Manny. He'll never get in, although he certainly deserves it because he was a hell of a baseball player. Another guy, steroids. He got suspended, I think, and then just retired because he was like, screw this. But like, he was a tremendous baseball player. On the juice, off the juice, I don't care. Manny Ramirez was the most, there has never been a baseball player before. There was obviously not before because he was already playing by the time I was born and growing up. So, but there's not a baseball player since Manny Ramirez that instills that fear in me. Jose Altuve comes really close because Jose Altuve beats the shit out of the Yankees every single time they play. And he always feels like he's going to do something absolutely horrible to them. And that is about as close of a feeling as I get for a rival baseball player than Manny Ramirez. Manny Ramirez, the fear that he instilled, like even when he left, Big Poppy was still there, but I was less threatened by Big Poppy as a Yankees fan when he was on the Red Sox without Manny Ramirez, even though he was still great. Like Manny just did something to you, dude, where it was like he stepped up to plate and you're like, oh, God damn it. Number 24 is in the box. You're going to absolutely ruin my day. Like that was the kind of player that Manny Ramirez was for me as a kid growing up watching baseball. Just the fear that he instilled as a hitter was insane. Omar Vizquel, great player. Seventh year on the ballot, 19.5. Like he might fall off the ballot. Pettit, unfortunately, the greatest postseason player of all time, pitcher of all time, is not going to be in the Hall of Fame, I guess, because he just doesn't have the regular season stats and he was never like a top Cy Young kind of guy. But Andy Pettit is an absolute beast. And if you ask me, he should be in the Hall of Fame. He has good enough stats in the regular season. And I just think being the greatest postseason player of pitcher of all time should go a long way, in my opinion. But I guess it just doesn't because he's only sitting at 17% in his sixth year. Bobby Abreu, 15.4%. It's his fifth year. Jimmy Rollins, 12.9%. It's his third year. Mark Burley, 10.8%. It's his fourth year. K-Rod, Francisco Rodriguez at 10.8% in his second year. And Torii Hunter at 6.9% in his fourth year. All those guys are probably dropping off the ballot. The new 2024 ballot, first-timers, Bobby Abreu, Jose Bautista, Carlos Beltran, second year on the ballot. I don't know why it says the 2024 ballot. That was weird. Adrian Beltre is the first year guy. Adrian Beltre is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Bartolo Colon, he has a good chance. I'm just not sure that Bartolo Colon, I don't know, man. He's a beast. Bartolo Colon might have an outside shot. Adrian Gonzalez, no. I don't think Adrian Gonzalez will get in. And the other first timers, Matt Holliday, he won't get in. David Wright, unfortunately, he won't get in. Victor Martinez, probably not. Joe Mauer, I think, will get in first ballot. He certainly deserves it. He's probably one of the... It's hard to be the best player as a catcher. It's very difficult. It is very, very difficult. Only really him and Buster Posey are guys that have won MVPs and been the best player on their team for several years. Like, Joe Mauer is a professional hitter. He's unbelievable, dude. And Joe Mauer certainly deserves to be a Hall of Famer. Brandon Phillips won't get in his first year on the ballot. Jose Reyes is never going to get in. I mentioned David Wright. Yeah, that, I don't know, man. I think Gary Sheffield, it would be, Chase Utley, first year on the ballot. If he gets in, I'm rioting. The Baseball Hall of Fame needs to be completely revamped if Chase Utley gets in and some of these other guys don't. I'm sorry. It would be really, it would just an absolute devastation if he got in over some of these guys. David Wright, my quick thoughts on David Wright. Loved him growing up. Thought he was a great player, great Met. An all-time New York Mets player, actually. And at one point, considered one of the best in the league. Overall, not just like third baseman, one of the best players in the league, best young, bright player. I remember his first All-Star game hitting a home run in his first at-bat. I think it was in Pittsburgh. Really, really cool. So he's a stud, and his career was unfortunately cut short with his back. By the time he turned 30, I think he played till he was technically 35 years old, but he played, I think, maybe half a season in 5 years. So his back completely derailed his career, and it was unfortunate to see that go the way it did. But that's the Hall of Fame ballot. Those are my thoughts. I'll write up something too, probably when the actual ballot is released on Tuesday night. But those are my thoughts on who's returning. The first timers that get in, probably only going to be Joe Mauer and Adrian Beltre. I'd be shocked if any other first year ballot got in. So that'll do it for this episode from my point of view. We'll wrap it up here. Thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. Have a great rest of your week. Great championship Sunday. Talk to you all next week.